Welcome to Talking Walking, hosted by Andrew Stuck from Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. Talking Walking brings you interviews with people from the world of walking, artists, activists, professionals, and those of us who have a passion for just taking a walk. Bradley Garrett describes himself as a professional trespasser who has been exploring many hidden places and spaces where we're not supposed to be. When he agreed to an interview, I wondered whether I'd be blindfolded, bundled in a car and taken to a remote destination. It wasn't quite like that, although we did travel by car to the outer edges of Southampton and then walked amongst motorways to reach a country route that took us to the River Test in full flood. Whether you judge him as a hero or a villain, there's no way of escaping his infectious enthusiasm for going into places that you or I might think twice about visiting. We're just crossing the River Test on a lovely sunset evening, cold in January, but what would you expect?
It's cold, but it's beautiful, and we managed to make it here from a very busy motorway where we almost got run over a number of times, so I'm quite happy we found this little piece of
rural area. This was what I kind of anticipated, that when I came to interview a man who has explored all sorts of different places, that I might be taken on a bit of a challenging walk.
I guess it's worth fleshing out what it is I do. Essentially, I'm a professional trespasser. I spend most of my time going into areas that are off limits to the public. And I have a particular interest as a geographer in hidden spaces that we are excluded from and spaces that we're not supposed to be. I guess on the extreme end of that scale, there's spaces like the Shard.
When you talk about the spaces on the extreme end, we are talking about someone who gets up to extreme things.
Yeah. When the Shard was under construction, we climbed it a number of times and took photos from the top of the building. And that received some interest, but we've also infiltrated a number of subterranean spaces, abandoned tube stations, the derelict post office railway, World War II bunkers. There are all sorts of hidden spaces in the city that people forget about. But the other side, of course, of place hacking is the more everyday side. People might think of this as being more mundane, but I think actually it's equally interesting going over spaces like a major motorway
where we
just came from, yeah, and you know, spaces where
clearly not designed for us,
not designed for pedestrians, in a space that makes you in a sense feel very unwelcome, right? These spaces that we've infiltrated in London, whether they're old spaces owned by the government that have fallen into neglect or disuse or disrepair, or spaces that are owned by major corporations and very heavily surveilled and policed, these are all spaces that we're not allowed and not supposed to access, right? So there's definitely something similar there between place hacking, what I do, recreational trespass, and the work of people like Will Self and Ian Sinclair, psychogeographers who tend to walk in places where they're not supposed to be walking.
One of the things I noticed just as we were walking along, and there's a bit of a Peter Pan in you, because as we walked past crash barriers, which had a almost horizontal surface, you couldn't resist leaping up and walking along this as though you were an Olympic beam gymnast. So, you know, there is a little bit of something going on all the time in the brain, isn't there? Oh, that looks fun.
It's simply a desire to want to participate with the environment that I'm in, whatever that environment happens to be. And I've always had that. I think we all have that when we're young, don't we? I mean, this is what kids do, right? If you see a surface that is traversable, you'll go for it. So it seems to me absurd that as we grow older, we stop ourselves, we censor ourselves. We don't do these things because it feels...
It's not a social norm, is it?
It's not socially appropriate,
yeah.
Right? And it's ridiculous. It's what if you can just step back from that mentality for a moment, you realize very quickly that this is a social construct that is being sort of laid over us like a grid, like a template, you know, that we're supposed to conform to. And actually lifting that template off doesn't take very much effort at all. And once you do it a couple of times, you realize that bodies are built for interacting with environments. This is what human beings do. And there's really nothing bizarre at all about climbing a fence or walking down a handrail on your feet.
I have to be honest, you know, when I walk along and I see something, I'm always curious. I always want to know what's beyond the gate or over the fence or whatever. But, you know, as you say, some kind of social norm says, no, I shouldn't go there. You know, that's not an area that I should be walking into. But you've not really had any qualms about that. Could you try and explain what it is in your mind that, you know, you go through? I mean, do you plan where you're going to explore, or sometimes is it purely opportunistic?
Yeah, sometimes it's spontaneous. You see something that's interesting and you go for it, or you're trying to get from point A to point B and there's a barrier between you, a fence or whatever, and you just go over it. People do this in rural areas, right? If you need to cross a farmer's field, most people wouldn't think twice about hopping over a barbed wire fence and crossing the field. But when you sort of translate that mentality into an urban context, somehow people find it more threatening. I don't really understand why. I remember walking around Oxford with Patrick Keeler, the filmmaker, and he was showing me this derelict quarry. And there was a sign there that said, you know, no trespassing, keep out, whatever. And I remembered the shot of the quarry from one of his films. And I said to him, well, was the fence not here when you came? And he said, no, the fence was in the way. I just put the camera over it. And it seemed to me, like, yes, of course, it's just common sense, right? The fence is in the way. Just get over the thing. But, you know, I think it's a mentality that more people could benefit from embracing.
Okay, so one of the things that puts me off too is that, and we just heard a dog out for a walk there, is that I'm always terrified of dogs, of guard dogs and all sorts. So do you stake out places first just to make sure that there isn't a dog on the other side?
Yeah, it really depends on where we're going. I mean, there's places that we spent years scoping, you know, looking for access, checking maps. You know, getting to those spaces was quite an effort. You know, it's really rewarding, actually, to study a space in that way and to really come to understand what constitutes a space, you know. Not just its kind of raw material geography, but the history of the place, the sociality that defines it. You know, you've got to come to know all of these things. So, for instance, if we're going to infiltrate an abandoned tube station in London, there's the raw, brute materiality of getting to the station that we have to confront, right? Like, you can't just walk into one. So we're going to have to find an air shaft, potentially. We're going to have to abseil down that air shaft. You know, then we may have to negotiate different kinds of barriers to access to get to it, right? So we need to know what we're coming up against before we abseil down that air shaft. Otherwise, you're very likely to just get stuck. So you need to know emergency exits. You need to potentially be prepared to come back up the rope you came down on. You know, all of these sorts of things.
I'm going to say there must be many a time when you come to a dead end.
Yeah, it happens a lot. But the other thing that you need to know is, when are the trains running? When do they stop? Do work trains run after the other trains stop? Are there any works planned on these parts of the tracks on this particular night? You know, are there security patrols? Do the security patrols walk on the tracks? You know, there are all sorts of other questions that need to be answered before you can step over that threshold. This, of course, is all knowledge that we're not supposed to have. And what an absurdity that as a, you know, someone who has lived in London for a very long time, I'm going to be denied access to my own public transportation system. You know, why can't I know whether there's people working on the tracks at that time? You know, this is a public space. It's funded with taxpayer money. It's funded with money that we pay into the system.
No concerns about terrorism or criminality in that way, in that sense? I know, you know, you might not see your own trespassing as a criminal act, because obviously trespassing isn't a criminal act, but you don't actually see that as a means to letting all sorts of other criminality take place.
I think that we need to use a bit of common sense and think through these things. You know, if someone was going to plot something nefarious on the tube, as they have before, why would they abseil down a 30-meter air shaft and squeeze through various layers of security and, you know, to get access to a derelict station to do what? You know, it doesn't really compute. We know from historic precedent that if someone wants to cause massive damage on the tube, you go down in rush hour with a suitcase, you know. And you can't stop that from happening. That's the bottom line. So I think, you know, suppressing citizens' desires to explore their own city in the name of terrorism doesn't make a lot of sense, and in fact is going to cause people to feel disinvested in the spaces that they live. And I think that that's actually very dangerous when you start robbing people of a sense of place.
Often enough, when you see something that says no ball games, the first thing you do is play with a ball.
So, of course, yeah.
I think it's...
You know, some of the best places that we've found as urban explorers are places that simply had signs that said no trespassing. Well, and what that indicates to a place hacker is there's something interesting past that sign, right? The best way to defend an urban location, I mean, here I'm going to get into trouble with fellow place hackers when they hear me telling them how to improve security, but, you know, the best way to defend a place is just don't mark it at all. You know, just let it be.
Well, which is very funny because, you know, I'm about to go to the Ordnance Survey, and that was what the Ordnance Survey did, was that obviously ordnance was about armament, and what they clearly did in mapping terms was that they didn't include any of the nuclear missile sites on Ordnance Survey maps.
Yeah, again, as a geographer, this is a really fascinating question, the politics of what gets on the map. You know, a map doesn't have a one-to-one relationship with reality. This is not an objective survey of what actually exists. So the way that we found a lot of these tube stations, the abandoned tube stations, is we compared 1932 maps to 2010 maps, and what you found is that there were a number of stations that were missing from the new map. The next step is to go and look for the missing station. Is it still there? You know, are there surface remains? Are there ticket offices? Are, you know, is there a platform?
Is your interest as much to do with the sort of kind of the archaeology of these forgotten places, or is it as much because you just, you know, adventure and thrill?
Well, interestingly, my master's degree is in archaeology, and I spent about 5 years working for the U.S. federal government doing archaeology. And when I began the PhD, I knew absolutely nothing about urban exploration. What I was interested in was a notion of alternative archaeologies, people who were defining archaeology on their own terms, you know, communities and groups that were sort of trying to take control of their local history and heritage. And urban explorers were one of the first groups I ran into. And I just realized quickly after meeting them that there was so much there. It was such a rich vein of inquiry. And so I followed that ethnography to its logical conclusion, which was...
Joining the gang, yeah?
Well, that was the only way to write that story. The urban explorer community, as you can imagine, is quite secretive about what they do. It's a very closed network. They have to be secretive about what they do because the authorities are constantly after them. Interesting question here about what it is the authorities are so frustrated by, right? Because it's not... it comes back to our conversation about maps, right? The authorities haven't put these places on maps because they don't want people to know that they're there, right? So when you effectively put them back on the map by taking photographs of them and sharing that information online, various authorities find that threatening. Now, I can understand why, to a degree, they don't want that information shared. But certainly in the case of tube stations, and various other public utilities like sewers and electricity tunnels and bunkers, you know, these are spaces that were built with taxpayer money. And if active, engaged citizens of a city are interested enough to go out and find out for themselves what happened to these spaces, you know, I think that you've got to give people a little bit of leeway.
No doubt they use the argument, you know, you're putting your lives at risk. There's a sort of health and safety aspect. If you're not putting your lives at risk, someone has to go and bloody well find you, because you're stuck around there, might be having their life put at risk. And what might you unearth, which might cause other people's lives to be at risk?
I mean, there is a kind of, like, a weird mythic component, you know, that people are kind of have various apprehensions about the underground, you know, an underground space and what it might harbor. And I think that the question about threat actually is, you know, as I said, it's actually less about a kind of logical, reasoned, thinking through what might happen in these spaces. And it's more about a kind of a weird, almost kind of religious fear of the underground, that something's going to be unleashed if people are just wandering around and they're opening stuff up. So I don't think it's that silly a question. I think that's definitely part of what's going on here.
Well, for a long time, I went to school in Wiltshire, and then I actually went to work for Wiltshire County Council. And Wiltshire is layer upon layer of archaeological remains from every possible period. But it also has an awful lot of military.
Underneath Wiltshire in Corsham, there is a huge underground city called Burlington. It was constructed during the Cold War. And it was essentially the space where the UK government would be rebuilt in the event of a nuclear attack on London. We knew where the bunker was because it was declassified in 2004. We got a hold of the documents, including maps to adjacent quarries, which indicated where the bunker was. And we went through one of the adjacent quarries until we actually reached the blast doors of the bunker. And amazingly enough, found a way into the bunker. And I couldn't believe what was in there. There was an underground telephone exchange. There was a kitchen that still had all of the plates and pots and pans. The telephone exchange had rotary telephones wrapped in plastic with the Queen's seal on them. And there were hundreds of them stacked up in a room. There were electric buggies that you could use to get around the entire base. And everything was sort of left in the state that it was. Oh, the best thing that was down there is there was a library that contained every document necessary to rebuild the UK government in the event of a nuclear attack. So try and imagine, what do you put in that library? Like, what are the most essential maps and documents that you need to reconstruct the government? You know, talk about fascinating archaeology. I mean, finding spaces like that, you can imagine.
Well, okay, so I'm going to have to ask you, you know, which was your most frightening expedition, and which is the expedition that you would love to say has been the sort of summit of achievement, whether that's necessarily in adventure or thrill or just in what you discovered when you were there?
Right. Okay, so last year we went to Belfast, and many people will be aware of May's Prison, where Bobby Sands and the hunger strikers died. May's Prison has been stuck in a state of limbo since it was shut down, because you can imagine the two factions in Northern Ireland either want the place preserved as a kind of historic monument or razed because it's a shrine to terrorism, depending on your perspective. So we went to Belfast wanting to sneak into the prison, and we went there, and what we found was that the prison gates were solidly shut, and there was no way in there. I mean, it's a prison, right? The fences are buried. You know, you can't climb over the walls. Whatever. Well, I found a climbing route over the front gate that I thought would work, but we needed to bring ropes with us to drop into the yard on the inside. So we went at about 2 in the morning. I climbed the front gate, chucked the walls over the inside, slid down the thing, and it was spectacular. I mean, in terms of well-preserved archaeological remains, or historical remains, I've never seen anything like it. We were able to get into the H blocks of the prison. We were able to see where the hunger strikers were. It was a pretty wild experience, but when we went to leave, we realized that I had tied the knots and the rope too far apart. We got stuck inside the prison. Now, getting stuck in a location happens every once in a while.
Some people listening to this would say, serve them right.
I mean, that is part of the risk, right? And there's a big, there's an onus here on personal responsibility with urban exploration. You have to know that you are putting yourself in that situation. You could be arrested, you could be killed, you could get trapped. You know, these are things that might happen. So, you know, these are willing risks. So we did get to the point where we thought, right, we might have to call someone and say that we're trapped. The big problem being in Mays was not the physical danger of being trapped. Obviously, it was the political danger that we were in. I mean, this is a space you know, that was, of course, built to keep people in at one time, which is now built specifically to keep people out. And we had gone over the walls in the most sort of blatant way you could imagine with these ropes, you know. It was not a good situation. So after debating this, the adrenaline really kicked in, because I realized we were well and truly trapped, and we had to get out of there. I just climbed like a beast and somehow made it to the top of that wall, just scrambled to the top of the wall, hand over hand. And once I was up there, I was able to lift over the bags and help everyone else out. But that was the closest I've ever come to being stuck. And stuck in a situation that if we had made that call, I think the repercussions would have been quite serious.
In fact, that sort of brings in a point that I didn't ask, really, is that you do work as a team, though, you because it's not something one does. I mean, obviously, there are plenty of people who might cross over and look into or climb walls or fences, but the urban explorer is very much a team kind of activity.
Yeah, it's a very social activity, both for safety reasons, because, you know, going in a group means that you can help each other get out of a situation. And sometimes it takes some pretty intense critical reasoning skills to get yourself through a location. So having, you know, three or four brains on the job actually really helps. Also, it's just exploring the city is so much more fun to do with a group of people.
What I usually ask people is suggest a walk. I'm not sure what I ought to be getting a suggestion from you, but can you think of something that to suggest people should give it a go?
Absolutely. It's not all about the kind of grand adventures. There are also the everyday walks that that I really love taking, and one of my favorites is taking the train up the River Lee to Broxbourne. Yep. Take the train to Broxbourne and begin walking south down the River Lee from there. There's a fantastic cafe that people will run into on the towpath there. It's a great place to have breakfast and then carry on the walk. And you can walk it all the way back into London. I mean, you can walk it to Finsbury Park and hop on the train. It's a long walk. It's a great one for a Sunday. You'll be exhausted by the end of it. And I guarantee it'll be beautiful. And you won't know that you're in London until you cross a certain threshold. And trying to pinpoint, I think, that moment of crossing the kind of urban-rural divide is really fun to try and pinpoint it.
You've been listening to Talking Walking, brought to you by Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. In this episode, you've heard from Bradley Garrett. If you have any views on this interview or any walking issues, we would love to hear from you. Just follow the links on the Talking Walking website. We look forward to having you along for future episodes of Talking Walking. Written, recorded and produced by Andrew Stuck of Rethinking Cities Limited, our artwork is designed by Ian Martin of Aardvark Graphics, and the music is composed by Simon Sanders of EZtronic.